First of all, I'll just say that there is a tradition according to which Chachmei Eretz Yisrael, right, the sages in Eretz Yisrael, actually had the view that you make a bracha before any mitzvah, period. That is something that has been argued both by more yeshivish scholars and by historians of liturgy. And we don't make a bracha. It's actually quite late, right, for something that seems so obvious to all of us. The classic source about this is the first source in your packet, where Rambam says something really striking here. He says, Chol mitzvot aseh shebein adam lemakom, bein mitzvah she'einah chova, bein mitzvah shehi chova, mevarech aleha kodem le'asiyata. Any mitzvah that is bein adam lemakom, whether it's obligatory or not obligatory, meaning it might be something like, what is a non-obligatory mitzvah? If I'm building a house, I have to build a ma'akeh, but I'm not obligated to build a house. So that's not an obligatory mitzvah. It's obligatory only if the situation emerges that creates an obligation. Okay? Now, I just want to give you a headache for a second and say that in the rules of formal logic, the conclusion from this that Rabbi Yosef Karo will derive is invalid as an argument in formal logic. Rabbi Yosef Karo, famously commenting on this Rambam, says, Rabbi Yosef Karo says about the Rambam, he meant what he said when he said mitzvot ben adam lemakom, because we don't make brachot ben adam lechaviro. Here's why this is unconvincing in formal logic. When someone says, kol mitzvot aseh, shebein adam lemakom, we make a bracha, the logical deduction from that is, not all mitzvot ben adam lechaviro do we make a bracha. In other words, from a perspective of formal logic, if this is confusing, you could just put this away, but from the perspective of formal logic, if I say any instance of X, we do Y, the conclusion of that is not any instance of non-X, we don't do Y. It's not all instances of non-X do we do Y. Right? In other words, to say, Rabbi Yosef Karo, here, I say this with tremendous dechilu urechimu, misreads the Rambam. I don't think the Rambam said what Rabbi Yosef Karo hears him as saying. Can you nod if you follow what I just said? Right? Right? It's not actually that complicated. I just said it in a very, like, obscure way. But, like, in other words, the deduction he draws is too expansive. Right? The proper deduction is, so not every mitzvah ben adam lechaviro does that apply. He concludes, no. All of those, none of those. That is not correct as a reading of the Rambam, but it is enormously influential in the unfolding of Jewish law. Interpretation number one, okay? This is really kind of fascinating. The Sefer HaItur basically argues, Sefer HaItur, you know, early medieval halachic text, argues that we don't make a bracha when it depends on how another person will react. So let me just read this to you for a minute. It says, Zeh haklal, kol mitzvah she'ina beino levein atzmo v'tluya ba'acherim, any mitzvah that is not kind of just me on my own doing it, right? Sarah decides to move into a sukkah. It's between her and the sukkah and God. Right? It doesn't depend on someone else saying, sure, you're welcome to come into this, right? It's a mitzvah, beinah levein atzmah. Any mitzvah like that, any mitzvah that is not like that, right? She'inah beinah levein atzmo, v'tluya ba'acherim, kigon tzedakah, v'ashavat avidah, v'ha'avot, uvikur cholim, v'domelehem, all of these mitzvot, which all happen to be interpersonal, ein tzarich levarech, we don't bless, afal gav de b'siyata gamar mitzvah, even though when you did it, you actually fulfilled a commandment. But v'chol mitzvah shehi beino levein atzmo, kigon sukkah, v'lulav, shofar, v'tzitzit, v'chol adomelehen, tzarich levarech. And then I will not read the rest, which is a technical halachic discussion about whether there's a bracha about ma'akeh. What he's saying is, it depends if it's me or me and someone else. And if it's me and someone else in the encounter, then we do not make a bracha. Now, Here's what I want to just sort of point out here, and I'm doing this, this should really be like a two-day seminar, but I'm going to try to do this sort of quickly. He seems to be offering what, on the surface at least, is a fairly formalistic legal point. It is possible that in a mitzvah that involves another person, the other person may not be open to receiving my action. I make a bracha, asher kishayim b'sav etzivanu al bikur cholim, and someone says, get out. I've had that experience in your space, right? Someone says, get out, right? Or someone says, you know, I'm like really feeling embarrassed right now about how bad I, don't come in here, right? So if it's dependent, I'm offering a reading here, okay? I'm doing this on purpose. You'll see what I'm doing in a second. If it's dependent on someone else's volition, I can't make a bracha. Now, here's the Rashba's version of the same thing, I think. Right? The Rashba says, Sha'alta liva'er lecha al ezo mitzvah mevarchin al asiyata va'al ezo ein mevarchin kegon tzedaka v'sharak milut chasadim. You ask for a clarification of the principle, says the Rashba, and he answers, Da, ki kol mitzvah she'ief sharlo bigmar asiyata le'hasot beino levein atzmo ela tzricha acher imo ein mevarchin aleha. As soon as there is another person involved, you don't make a bracha. Kigon, tzedakah uvikur cholim v'chayotzei bazeh. You don't make a bracha when there is another person who is implicated. And then he says, he draws out the point that maybe is only implicit in Sefer HaItur. She'im ein lekabel, o she'ino rotzeh lekabel. Maybe there's someone, no one needs tzedakah right now. Or maybe someone says, no, thank you. That is against my dignity. I will not receive your help. Or V'chein bikur cholim, she'im ein chole levakro, which I assume here means if there is not a sick person who wants to be visited, not if there's no one sick, right? O she'eino rotze bevikuro, or actively doesn't want you to visit, those are related, right? Iyev sharlo la'asota, ein mevarech aleim v'chein kol yotze bahen. Anytime someone might say no, then you don't make a bracha. Now, I want to suggest that this, you know, I'm in the Hadart Meit Midrash, in which the assumption is that law is never merely formalism. However, this feels to me, on the surface at least, like you can read this as a purely formalistic technical concern. Maybe I'll end up making a bracha levatala. Maybe I'll make a bracha, and then you'll say, no, sorry, I don't want a visitor, and then I've done the wrong thing, quote unquote, right? This is like, answer number one is sort of technical, right? Except, here comes the Israeli philosopher Avi Sagi and wants to say, oh, no, 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 this is not formalism. This is about acknowledging the full humanity and participation in the ethical encounter of the other person who is there. Now, I will just say before we read this, just to sort of give away my deck, I think Avi Sagi's interpretation here is beautiful, and I remain highly skeptical that it's what the Itur or the Rashba are saying. I think that's not what they're saying. But what he says is magnificent, okay? So here's Avi Sagi. This is Avi Sagi is professor at Bar-Ilan University. He writes a book during COVID, Or Mitoch HaSedek, which is an allusion to the Leonard Cohen song, Light Through the Crack, right? That's how the light gets in, right? This is, again, what I'm going to call the valuization of what I think is a formalistic response. The valuization is its own good argument. I'm just not sure that it's actually the Rashba's argument. Okay? Here's what he says. In order to fulfill the mitzvah of tzedakah, it is not enough to have a desire to give that is one-sided, but rather the person who is the recipient must make themselves available. If the person does not make themselves available, so maybe you fulfill the mitzvah technically, but you haven't fulfilled the relationship that is desired. The fact that there is no bracha here is a clear, notice, it is a clear expression of a deep obligation of a person to turn to the other, to see his face, his life, and his needs. The command of God is not to engage in acts that are interpersonal on the assumption that the recipient is not actually a person, but only an object. Again, this is a gorgeous reading of why you wouldn't make a bracha on mitzvah ben adam l'chaviro, and I don't know how many of you would be like, oh yeah, that's what the Rashba was saying. It's actually important to say this is not mitzvah beino levein atzmo in the sense that some sort of liberal-minded people like me might want to say, oh, you have certain obligations to yourself. That's not what this means, right? This means one that you can fulfill entirely based on your own decision, right? That would be another new category, which I think there's precedent for in the tradition, but not in that language. Mitzvah beino atzmo, like, I have an obligation to, like, care for my health. That's not what this is, right? No, I know you know that. I'm just trying to make that, I want to sort of draw that out. It's an idiosyncratic use because it's, when you compare that to mitzvot ben adam l'chavero and ben adam l'makom, mitzvot ben adam levein atzmo could understandably be misread as my obligations towards myself. That's not what this means. Beino levein atzmo means that which I can accomplish entirely without another person being involved, like Sarah going into her sukkah. Sorry, I keep using your name, right? Is it right? Okay. By the way, it's also not clear to me that this is a great argument about beino levein atzmo. I'll give you another example. We make birkot erusin. Right? I mean, what if a man says that? A woman says, are you kidding me? Right? It's an ad hoc argument. You see what I'm saying? Right? It's another argument for why it's an ad hoc argument. You understand what I mean by ad hoc? Right? It's like, you know we don't do this, so you're coming up with a rationale for not doing it, but the argument doesn't work so well. First of all, Josh's point, you can go to a hospital, you can make sure the person wants to see you, but also, there are brachot that are not ben adam latzmo, and we do make a bracha, right? This is not, let's call it, an ironclad argument. There are holes here. It leaks. That's explanation number one, okay? Again, the two versions of it. Avi Sagi's beautification and deepening of, I'm saying that not sarcastically at all. I do think what he's saying is quite powerful. I just am not sure that it's what they're saying. Okay, here's, I think, something really beautiful. Explanation, we'll call this explanation number two. This is Rabbeinu Bachya, not Rabbeinu Bachya ibn Pakuda, Rabbeinu Bachya ibn Asher, who is the parshan on the Torah, and author of Kad HaKemach. And he says something which I'm going to guess that if we read this slowly, some people would be offended by. And the more I sit with this, the more I think he's actually saying something quite profound and actually sort of interesting. I first read this and I was like, oh. And now I've totally come around. So can anyone willing to read this Rabbeinu Bachya? Please, go ahead.
It is well known that the sanctity of Israel depends on these both. As they said in the Sefer, you shall be sanctified. This is the sanctity of mitzvah. And these mitzvot through which we are commanded to sanctify ourselves, they are the received mitzvot, which are the...
Received mitzvot, I just want to sort of be clear, mitzvot mekubalot refers to revealed mitzvot, as opposed to mitzvot derived from reason. Okay, go ahead.
Which is why our rabbis of blessed memory, the sages of truth, established for us that we should bless on them who sanctify us with his commandments and commanded us. And it is on account of these received mitzvot that at Sinai, Israel were called a holy nation, as it is said in Shemot, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Because of fulfilling the rationally self-evident mitzvot
muskalot, okay? That's my best attempt to translate muskalot, rationally self-evident, okay? Go ahead.
The nation would not be called a holy nation. After all, even idol worshippers, who are people devoid of wisdom and who have no understanding, do they not engage somewhat in the rationally self-evident mitzvot?
Okay, stop there for one sec. So I just want to make sure we understand what he said, because it's actually really striking. He's saying our holiness consists in what sets us apart from other nations. And that can't be rationally self-evident mitzvot, because those are rationally self-evident, and we are not the only people who are rational. So even idolaters, all the more so non-idolatrous non-Jews, visit sick people. Now, I want to try to formulate this in a more interesting way. This is close to how Avi Sagi formulates it, but it might not be the same. I'm not sure. We live in a shared moral community with non-Jews. So our moral commandments cannot be what make us holy if holiness means being different. Now, you might want to say, this is why I thought some people might not like this. What do you mean? I can think of nothing more holy than being moral, right? He's like, that's not what we mean by holy. I'm not saying, he's saying, that the only thing that is important is what's holy. There are some things that are enormously important, but they're not holy. I'm not even asking you to buy that this should be your definition of holy, only that you understand that it's his definition of holy. Holy is what makes us different. What makes us different are revealed commands. Shabbos, Kashrut, Tarat HaMishpacha, Sukkah, Afikomen. I don't know, make up whatever list you want, right? It's not, he says, not stealing. Not stealing is not unique to Jews. Not committing adultery is not unique to Jews. Therefore, we only say Asher Kishanu Mitzvotav V'Tzivanu when it comes to that which is distinctive, which is only that which is revealed. Because Jews are not the only rational people in the world. In fact, in my experience, Jews are less rational. No, that was a little joke. That's me, not him. You follow me, right? That's what I think he's basically trying to lay out as the position. The reason we don't say Asher Kishanu Mitzvotav V'Tzivanu on visiting the sick is that's a human category. It is amplified and celebrated and affirmed in Jewish texts, but it's not a revealed commandment. And therefore, it doesn't make us separate. The implications of living in shared moral community are such that that can't be that on which we claim to be holy. So let's leave this and move on to the sort of the third argument. And here I want to just mention this, and then I would like to dive into the one you did in Chavruta. This is a text that I had been unfamiliar with. This I got from something Avi Sagi wrote. This is the Shem Aryeh, who makes the point, we won't read this inside, I invite you to read it later. He makes the really interesting point, if I understand him correctly. When you say the word Vitzivanu, you should be saying that about things that you only do because you were commanded to. And interpersonal mitzvot are not like that, because you may also do them because God commands you. If I say, Nico, why don't you steal? And Nico says, because God says it's usser. What? God says I'm forbidden to. I would say, I don't really believe you. You also don't steal because you think rationally, that's just not, because you've read Kant, because you have a basic moral intuition, because your parents raised you right. In other words, any time that the reason for observance is mixed with human rationality, you wouldn't make a bracha. Because that's not what Vitzivanu means. This is also a stipulated definition, which is that Vitzivanu should be exclusive. You following what I just said? Yeah. Right? The reason Kyle shakes the lulav is because God told him to. The reason Kyle does not assault people on the street is because he's a good guy and he realizes it's morally prohibited to do that. And also it's forbidden. That's not where you'd make a bracha. And I don't know how to make that like elegant and like philosophically compelling. I think it's just sort of an interesting way of imagining commandedness, which is it's an acknowledgement that there are plenty of things we do that have multiple grounds, and halacha itself can accept that you don't just do things because God said so. The last explanation, which is the one I hoped we could dive into, that I asked you to read. So this is another Vitzivanu argument, but tell me conceptually, what is the argument about Vitzivanu here? In what's called it the Weinberg Rabinovich school. He's saying, don't you understand that Vitzivanu is the wrong motivation? Right? It's an astonishing argument, actually, for a traditional posek to make. If I stop outside a hospital room and I say, Asher kishami zutav v'tzivanu. It is not that I might get turned away. It is not about the epistemology of how I know. It is that I would be instilling the wrong kavana. Because the right kavana is, why am I visiting you? You're sick. How would I not? Not, I'm obligated. That's his argument. It's an incredibly bold argument, right? He's basically saying a bracha would be religiously and ethically counterproductive. Right? This is the most radical version of an argument here that you're going to find in traditional sources. It's not that Gentiles also, it's nothing like that. It's that that's the wrong thing to do. By the way, there is a very famous article in contemporary American moral philosophy. It has nothing to do with Judaism, but it is exactly this. Famous example given by the philosopher Michael Stocker. He says, you go to the hospital, you visit your friend who's been lonely and depressed, and you get her to laugh, and you get her to talk, and you get up to leave, and she says, thank you so much for coming. And you say, oh, don't thank me, I was obligated. And he says, most people understand that you're not just stupid for saying that, but you're also confessing that you didn't come for a morally ideal reason. The person is hurt for a good reason, because they don't want you there just because you're obligated. They want you there because you love them. I think that's basically Weinberg's argument. You follow the association I'm making? That's Weinberg's argument. Nobody wants you. By the way, I don't know if it's true that nobody wants you to do that, but let's just sort of go with that for a second. Nobody wants you to come to their hospital because it's a mitzvah. They want you to come to the hospital because you care about them. Therefore, it would be religiously and morally and interpersonally counterproductive to make a bracha. That's his argument. Yeah, I suspect it's both, right? Because there's a concern here with character. Who am I? And also, there's potentially, he might say, a violation of the other person, right? There's that back to that issue of turning the other person into an object. You're in the hospital? Oh, I have an opportunity to do a mitzvah, right? It's a really sick thing to say or to think. But so that's essentially his argument. And he makes what is an amazingly beautiful case here that I want to make sure people actually understood what he's doing. Because in the guise of writing a little essay on halacha, he's actually kind of making an argument about moral philosophy, right? He says, look, mishloach manot is just about love. So if you're not going to do it lovingly, don't bother. Ah, but then why does the halacha say that a beit din forces you to give tzedakah? Because there, someone actually needs the food. Yeah. Right? So the way that this is Shai talking, not him. In Judaism, virtue is so important that it's the second most important thing in ethics. The first most important thing in ethics is that a human need gets met. And halakha doesn't wait for me to be virtuous before need gets met. If a court has to beat me into giving tzedakah, it does. But it's not going to beat me into giving mishloach manot, because who cares? I don't mean that, who cares. But you know what I'm saying? Like, there's actually no there, because all mishloach manot is an expression of love. I will tell you, most of these sources I had never seen before the last month. What got me interested in this question was stumbling upon this tshuva, quote unquote, of Rav Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg many years ago, and it was an amazing moment. I think I said this to you, Sarah, earlier. So I taught this source in some public lecture at Hadar, and a woman got up and she said, I live in a Haredi neighborhood in Brooklyn, and I just want to say that if someone doesn't give me shalach manis, it is an act of actively humiliating and excluding me. Would Rav Weinberg say that in my community, a beit din would be kofeh on mishloach manot? You follow what I just said? I said that in very yeshivish, but like, right? And I was like, that's a great question, and probably yes, even, right? Because there, it is a need of being seen as a human or a member of the community. You know, in other words, maybe it's, her point was, maybe it's situational. Maybe there are some contexts where a beit din would be kofeh on mishloach manot because the implications of not giving mishloach manot are different than what he was assuming they were living where he was living. But just so you understand, that's his argument, right? And it's quite a bold argument because you might be inclined to say, wait a minute, Halacha always thinks doing things gadol ha-mitzuveh ve'oseh mimi she'eino mitzuveh ve'oseh, right? Greater is the one who does because they're commanded. And that's where he then turns to the Rambam and says, no, no, no. The Rambam already made it clear to us that that's only true about ritual mitzvot. Of course it's not better to visit the sick because you're obligated than to visit the sick because you're not obligated or not because you're obligated. Of course that's not what it means. It's talking about mitzvot ben adam l'makom. That principle only applies to mitzvot ben adam l'makom. It is, I'm not arguing right now with whether you agree with that principle, right? People here have all kinds of worldviews, but like, he's saying, when the Gemara says that, it's talking about Hilchot Shabbat. It's not talking about Nichum Avelim. It is simply not true that it is better to go to a Shiva because you have to than to go to Shiva because you want to. That's just not true. And what he argues is, and the Rambam already taught us that. Because what did the Rambam say? I don't want to do this, but I have to, is something you only say about ritual mitzvot. You wouldn't say that about, I don't want to go to the hospital. I'd be happy to never visit another sick person again, but what am I going to do? God says I have to. Rambam says, that thought is a sign of defect of character. That's vice. The lack of desire. Well, this is his positivization of the negative formulation of the Rambam. Is the very thought is vice. The Rambam already said, he says, that there are certain things that you do because your character is such that you do them. And there are certain things that you don't do because your character is such that you don't do them. And if that's the case, then you dafka don't want to be making a bracha on Ben Adam L'Chaveiro because that would make you merely obedient as opposed to good. I have to say that the older I get, the less persuaded by what Rav Yaakov Yehoshua Weinberg is doing here I am, because it's just not clear to me. I'm going to make an argument against him from, as it were, a more traditional view. It's just not clear to me that the stark dichotomy of because I have to or because I want to is really so strong in the history of Jewish ethics. I feel like this argument is, in a funny way, too liberal, right? Like, and this is David's second point, I think, I think this is true about a lot of discussions in moral philosophy. In my experience, a lot of discussions in moral philosophy simply don't deal with the complexity of motivation well enough. People don't usually do things either because of A or B. They do it because of some undistinguishable soup of A and B. So this becomes like a really interesting theoretical point that I struggle with figuring out, how does it work in real life? I don't know, maybe I'll just make myself the bad guy here. You know, as someone who lives with like chronic illness and like whatever, sometimes I make Shiva calls because I have to. And sometimes I make Shiva calls, yeah, I would say 26% of me wants to and 74% of me thinks I have to. Moral philosophers are not great at cases like that. They're just not, it's too messy for kind of philosophical thinkers. It's like, well, you're doing A, you're doing B. The answer is yes. I'm doing A and I'm doing B. And I can't even tell half the time, right? And so that's where this leaves me a little nervous. Like, I don't love the argument, actually. Like, I find it both very beautiful and also too simple. Let's for a minute back up. I want to make sure you understand for a second why the Rambam's argument is like such a breathtaking moment in Jewish thought. So just sort of think about this for a second. Imagine how the Gemara deals with like two seemingly contradictory positions, which it is convinced must be saying the same thing. And so you'll have some kind of okimta, right, that makes the two statements work together. The Rambam, in this way, that is like you have to be paying attention to see it, but if you're paying attention, it's astonishing, basically sets up a classic rabbinic debate of which the two sides are the rabbinic corpus and Aristotle. And the operative assumption is they can't be contradictory. Why can't they be contradictory? Because they're both right. I once asked my late teacher, Professor Isidore Twersky, in a seminar, did the Rambam really believe that Chazal were Aristotelians? And he said, what do you mean? First of all, he's not living in a historicist culture where he's like, oh, well, how could that be, right? He's simply assuming Chazal are true. Aristotle is right. Chazal and Aristotle are saying the same thing. They have to be. Let me show you how. That's what this essay is. This essay is a let me show you how. I know you think that Chazal said it's better to want to do something but not do it because it's usher. Whereas Aristotle says, no, you should not want to do bad things. He says, yeah, look at the examples that the sages bring. They're all ritual. They're not saying that I should want to mug Jared and not do it. Of course they know that nobody sane says i'afshi li b'takanazu about robbery. Who says that? But you might say afshili about, like, I don't know, like, whatever your own version of a prohibition on Shabbat is. So what Rambam ends up saying is, look, I've just shown you that Aristotle and the rabbis say the same thing. They say the same thing. The rabbis also think that the interpersonal, of course you shouldn't want to do it and not do it because it's forbidden. And that argument in the Rambam allows Weinberg and Rabinovich to say, and that's why we don't make brachot. Because that would say, I'm only doing it because God said no. Right? That's how all these pieces begin to work together. Right? All the pieces now hang together as an argument. You know, convincing or not. I'll just sort of say, by way of closing, I'm not trying to wrap this in some bow, God knows. I was hoping this year would work on two levels. One is to actually look at a fascinating, actual, concrete question of how an anomalous or seemingly anomalous Jewish practice can raise discussions of some of the most fundamental questions of what it means to be Jewish, human, and the relationship between those two things. And at a second level, I was sort of trying to show that you can take a discussion that seems to be kind of like technical and actually, if you push at it hard enough, end up realizing that, like, quote unquote, technical discussions can be incredible opportunities for thinking about values. Meaning, I wanted both the topic and what the topic says about the larger project of learning Torah. That was sort of what I was trying to sort of get us to do and think about together. I hope that was clear. The first one is more important to me than the second, meaning because I think that the issues they actually raise are really, really important. And the last piece is to me just mind-spinningly interesting about, like, the proper motivation and the ideal motivation, and, like, Jews struggle with this, philosophers struggle with this, everyone struggles with this. But also, it would be delightful to me if people were like, oh, discussions of sources that seem like obscure and not that interesting can actually be about really interesting things if I learn to hold them up to the light at a particular angle. Shakoach. Thank you.